This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When we're trying to manage sustainability and nutrition for our families and connect with our community, connection, I think, is even more nourishing than the food itself.
We all grew up hearing that you are what you eat, but the evolution of our planet's food distribution system has managed to create tremendous distances between our food sources and our dining tables. Today's guests on Sea Change Radio are both promoting eating local and close to the source and helping us wade through the ocean of food choices that confront us all on a daily basis. First, we speak with filmmaker Sophie Constantino, whose online film project Lunch Love Community features a school district that has had a small revolution in its approach to meals and now serves healthier foods grown in school-run gardens and farms. After that, we hear from clean food evangelist Terry Walters, whose cookbooks tell readers how to eat seasonally, locally, and sustainably without punishing their inner gourmand. So my guest today on Sea Change Radio is Sophie Constantino. She's the co-founder of Citizen Film, which is a nonprofit documentary production company in San Francisco. Sophie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So your latest project is the Lunch Love Community Project, which is chronicling the school lunch program that's been completely overhauled in Berkeley, California. Can you tell us a little bit about what the genesis of the Lunch Love Project and what it is today and where it's heading?
About 14 years ago, a group of parents and, you know, and politicians got together and they said, we need to make a change. There were angry parents, there were frustrated community members, and they were looking at the Supremo burritos and the chicken nuggets and saying, this is not healthy food. And, you know, you can see that that would happen in Berkeley, where there's such a passion for organic and doing the right thing and sort of social justice. And they're looking at the school lunch program, and the school lunch program, just, you know, as a background, there's free and reduced food, which is provided for low-income students. So there's a whole population, 50% of the population qualifies for lunch at school. And this might be the only meal they get in a day. So they come to school hungry and they wait till lunch. Maybe if they have a breakfast program, they'll get something for breakfast. But what was happening and what happens across the nation is that it's some funky, sugary thing for breakfast, and it's, you know, chicken nuggets or pizza for lunch, and that's not, you know, that's not quality food. That's not brain food. It's really just filler. And if this is the only meal you have in a day, it's we're really pushing the sort of class boundaries of success, because, you know, the achievement gap doesn't happen just because someone's poor. It happens for many reasons, and nutrition, I think, is a big one. So we saw this sort of burgeoning change happening in Berkeley, and the sort of slow process of coming up with a policy, coming up with an initiative, and coming up with bonds to create a kitchen. And then sort of over the last 3 years, the kitchen was built. They completely overhauled the food that's being served. And we saw this incredible transformation where there's cooking classes and gardening classes, there's gardens in every school, and the kids are eating healthy food. And they've seen, and they've been able to track, you know, real sort of behavioral changes, where no longer do you have all of the problems that you have when kids are coming to school hungry, or, you know, pumped up on sugary snacks, or, you know, soda for breakfast.
And the film angle of this?
So, you know, we started with the goal of making this documentary. And what we realized was that, you know, with the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act coming up, and with the sort of immediacy we saw, you know, as Michelle Obama started talking about childhood obesity and the issues that are facing this country, we saw these issues coming to the forefront. And we decided that, in fact, a much more robust approach would be more mobile media, more online media, creating short films that are both artistic but also are tools for parents, teachers, you know, administrators across the nation to say, look, they did this, they built this garden, it's not that hard, let's do it.
And that's one of the things that people around the country would think is like, well, it's Berkeley and everybody's a hippie there, and of course they're going to have vegan food, and you go to San Francisco Giants, you can probably get sushi. So people like to make fun of this, but there's more to it. And it's not just a whole bunch of rich kids who are getting the best food possible.
When we talk to people across the nation, there's some real misconceptions about Berkeley and about the demographics. And, you know, they're different. Demographics are different everywhere. But if 50% of the kids going to school in the Berkeley School District qualify for free and reduced lunch, then that means that 50% of the kids who are in school are living below the poverty line. So, you know, I think, you know, the numbers are, I'm not being precise about them, but that's significant. And I think that we underplay that when we think of Berkeley, because we think of the university and we think of, you know, the sort of radical hippies. But what we know is that this happens all over the nation, that there's a need. And I think that there's, just as much as Berkeley has these radical politics, it's also hard. You know, there's a lot of resistance. People don't like change. And people don't like change, especially in institutions like, you know, the school district, because it means administrators, it means paperwork, it means really changing so many things. And it means a lot of overtime for a lot of people who, you know, are already overworked and overstretched as it is.
There was one, and for our listeners, there's six right now, six webisodes that are posted on the lunchlovecommunity.org website, and I recommend everyone check it out so that they can get a better idea what we're talking about. But one of them didn't have any narration. It was just all the facts and all the costs that go into this kind of overhaul. Can you go through a little bit about the overall costs per kid and how that's affected by a transformation like this?
Well, the piece you're talking about is The Labor of Lunch. And it, you know, what, as filmmakers, what we were so struck by is just watching how much work goes into making 5,000 lunches a day, you know, and 6,500 breakfasts. So in Berkeley, they adopted this universal breakfast program. So the kids get breakfast, all the kids get breakfast. It's not just the kids that are in the free and reduced program.
So free breakfast
for all? Free breakfast for everybody.
And it's not just like a bagel.
No, it's not just like a bagel. There's a collection of healthy, different healthy breakfasts, but they have fruit, they have a cereal, they have, and it, you know, there's no high fructose corn syrup, no, you know, artificial ingredients. There's a pretty wide selection.
Are they sitting down in the cafeteria to eat their breakfast, or is this kind of breakfast on the go generally?
This is breakfast in the classroom. And there was a lot of controversy when they started the breakfast in the classroom, because the teachers were like, oh no, you're going to take away 5 minutes of my precious teaching time. But in fact, the kids sit down, they eat their breakfast, they put it away. There are no bugs and vermins running around. Everybody understands about cleanliness and they get on with their day. And you know, I don't know about you, but I have a clearer mind after I've had breakfast.
I think a lot of people who are in the habit of having breakfast first thing in the morning would be surprised to find out that there's a pretty significant percentage of children who go to school with empty stomachs.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, they have some change and they pick up a soda at the corner store on their way to school. I mean, I think that's another shocking piece. And, you know, I think this, we're seeing a sea change. We're seeing a shift in this country where suddenly people are realizing, no, we don't need junk food in schools. No, we shouldn't have soda machines in schools, because you're basically providing kids with access to crap, things that are bad for them, you know, and that don't promote health. And if you have a choice with your lunch money that your mom gives you to buy a Coca-Cola or, you know, to buy a sandwich, kids make decisions that please them rather than the decisions that are best for them. So you're going to still see this. I mean, in Berkeley, you still see kids, they run off to the corner store and they're going to buy Cheetos and they're going to buy Doritos and soda pop. But they now do it as most adults do, with a slightly conflicted mind. You know, I know this is bad for me, or I know this isn't the best way to get my calories, but today I'm going to treat myself to a little junk food. Not the end of the world. And I think that that's one of the things we also try to highlight is this isn't a dictatorial state in Berkeley where you must only eat organic, locally grown food. Kids have choices, but they have choices in their free time. And when they're at school, the choices to buy a Coke from the vending machine has been taken away from them.
Middle fish bites if you got good beef. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. Put him in the pot, baby, put him in the pan, honey, cook him till he's nice and brown. Make a batch of buttermilk, whole cakes, mama, and chew them things and then chomp them on down. Singing, any fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing to play the blues.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Sophie Constantino, who's the co-founder of Citizen Film. It's a nonprofit documentary production company, and we're talking about her Lunch Love Community project. So getting back to the costs, how was it before? Can you contrast what the price was? This is $4.90 per student. What was it before?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And part of the overhaul also sort of exposed, we don't want to say corruption, but exposed some very strange accounting. But you see that people talk about this from school districts all over, that in fact, the most lunch programs run in the red. They say, oh, well, you know, we can't make ends meet even with our subsidies and our commodities. Like the government will give. So if the farm bill passes and they say, okay, we're going to subsidize corn for this much, then they have a whole bucket load of corn and then they can give it to the schools, you know, from the sort of the commodity. And that's part of how you do the equation of where you get your food from. So before the overhaul, it was a little unclear, but they said that they worked in the red and that they were never breaking even, that the cost of buying the food from the government for these ready-made, you know, chicken nugget things, what happens is there's a company who takes the chicken from the subsidy, the government subsidies, and smashes it up and grinds it and turns it into a nugget and covers it with, you know, breadcrumbs and packages it and then sends it out to the schools. And then the schools reheat that and they pay a price for that. But the when push comes to shove after the building of the kitchen, actually making a chicken meal and using fresh vegetables and using, you know, real food makes for a almost more efficient meal. I mean, you have to pay everybody to work, but it's good for people to have jobs that aren't just warming up food.
So it's not like the cost shot up from $3 a head to $4.90 once they instituted this much more localized food sourcing system, right?
Yeah, correct.
And the Berkeley school system has obviously benefited from the influence of luminaries like Alice Waters, who helped create the slow food movement. Can you talk about this dynamic that's portrayed in one of the shorts called The Parent Factor, I believe?
You know, this project is an amazing cross-section between sort of citizen action and celebrity action. And, you know, in many ways, you can look at this story from the celebrity point of view. There's been a couple celebrities that have really motivated change and have really been sort of visionaries from the very beginning. And Alice Waters is one of those people. She really envisioned the edible schoolyard. She started at the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School. It's an acre. It's amazing. They have chickens. They have compost. They have all kinds of both native and native flowers, native plants, vegetables, fruits, you name it, it's there. And then they have a kitchen facility where they do cooking classes. Again, gorgeous. And within the true spirit of a pioneer like Alice Waters, it has all of those aesthetic qualities, the sort of principles of good living and coming back to the earth. And So she, Alice Waters, definitely gets a lot of credit for the motivation of this change. But there's the other side of the story, which was really frustrated, angry parents, unemployed politicians, people who said, you know what, this needs to change, not just a garden here or a classroom there, but it needs to be systemic change, and it needs to be across the entire school district. It needs to go to all kids. It can't just go to some, and it has to start in kindergarten, and it has to start in the poor kindergarten as well as the middle class kindergartens. So these parents really motivated a policy to be written, motivated the grants to be written so that they could study and practice this. People were hired to teach. There were curriculum writers. The Center for Ecoliteracy was a huge proponent of creating curriculum that then could be adapted depending on the age level. So, you know, if it's sixth grade science, your sixth grade science can reflect back on what you learn in the garden, or you can learn things in the garden that will reflect back on your sixth grade science class. So that synthesis was a sort of part of the parent factor and part of the movement that parents and teachers got together and really pushed for this.
What do you think are some of the keys to accelerating growth of these kind of programs?
Well, I think it's a perfect storm between parents and government and an awareness, a sort of a social awareness of the issues that are really motivating people, whether they're motivating parents or teachers or administrators. But, you know, I think if you're in Atlanta, Georgia, and you're saying that things should be different, what we've done is by making these short pieces that are sort of web-friendly, shareable, usable, you can watch them on your mobile device or you can watch them, you know, online anywhere. You can post them to your blog. You can share them with your PTA. Seeing and watching what has happened is also sort of tools for changing your own environment and knowing it's possible. I think if you go into the garden through the movie and you see the joy and you see the possibilities and you hear from, you know, the garden teacher that actually, you know, it started as a very small plot of land with fava beans and it's grown and grown and grown into this kind of magic secret garden. You can see that it's possible. And I think that knowing things are possible and knowing that it just takes a few motivated people to make change is really important. And I think it's also really important to know that Berkeley did something which was mammoth. They did both curriculum, school lunch, and the creation of these gardens and cooking classes. You don't have to do everything. It's possible to start with a garden. It's possible to start thinking about children gardening and rethinking the way their relationship to fruits and vegetables work. It's really possible to make some changes to your lunch program. It doesn't have to be completely overhauled. It can be, you know what, I want to vote for whole grains, or I think we need more, you know, fresh fruit, more locally grown fruit, more, you know, whatever that thing is that you know you can do. I think making those changes are very possible. And, you know, it's interesting. San Francisco is this sort of much bigger model, and it's been a much slower change. But likewise, San Francisco is seeing changes in what the content of the food is. Now, there are little gardens popping up everywhere. People are talking about cooking classes and after-school programs or having cooking classes, which is great. It's a very different, on a very different scale. It's tiny compared to Berkeley, which every school from K through 12 now has a big piece of this as part of their institution.
Well, I strongly recommend our listeners to go to lunchlovecommunity.org and check out the films that are there. And we're looking forward to what's coming down the pipeline. My guest has been Sophie Constantino. She's a filmmaker and the co-founder of Citizen Film, which is a nonprofit documentary production company in San Francisco. Sophie, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've had my share, and from now on, I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. I'm betting everything I got on you. Mama, I'm giving all my love to one baby. Lord help me if my baby don't come through. I've got a great big amount saved up in my...
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My next guest on Sea Change Radio is the author of the best-selling cookbooks Clean Food and her most recent cookbook, Clean Start, Terry Walters. Terry, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
So is the decision to present a vegan cookbook, and while you're not a vegetarian, you try to limit the amount of animal products in your diet, is that more from a health standpoint or is it more from a sustainability perspective?
It has changed over the years. When I first started down on this path, it was for my health. With heart disease in my family, we never really ate that much red meat to begin with, but we did eat poultry and fish. And when I discovered that I had high cholesterol at a very young age, I realized a doctor who I'll never forget, greatest gift ever given, said you really need to eat more brown rice and kale. And so I started doing that. And the vegan diet is the one that makes me feel the best, gives me the most energy, and I've been able to maintain my health doing so. And as a health counselor, I've helped others do the same. But you know, the source of our food has changed so dramatically over the last two decades. So my approach, while it is vegan and while it started for my health benefits, I also spend a great deal of time at an urban organic farm here in Connecticut. And I just feel as though, you know, knowing what it takes to raise animals, to transport, I don't love the idea of killing animals for our own benefit, especially since there's so many other sources of protein that can sustain us and will sustain our environment. But I do work with people who do need medicinal quantities of good, clean animal protein. So I try not to make a judgment that's not necessarily going to be in everybody's interest across the board.
If you had to choose between organic blueberries that were flown in from Chile and frozen organic blueberries, which would you be more inclined to take? There's a lot of decisions you make just walking into your local grocery store, aren't there?
There absolutely are. And before I even walk into the store, I encourage my clients especially to stop for a second and take a deep breath and just connect with your intention so that you don't go through the store in a blur and buy the things that you think you need. You can make better choices. You can think about the choices that you're making and just reconnect with what it is that you're trying to accomplish. So first, that answers would be different according to the season and the need. So if blueberries aren't in season, first, I'm never going to buy the blueberries from Chile, period. It's just not going to happen. If it were the middle of winter here in Connecticut and we just wanted to have blueberries, a craving, or it just felt like a great treat, I'm more likely to buy the frozen blueberries or pull out the blueberries that we froze ourselves in, you know, the summer. If we're lucky enough that there are any left, if that's, you know, moving beyond that, I'm much more likely to say it's the middle of the winter. Maybe we, instead of making a blueberry tart, why don't we look at making a pear cake or, you know, an apple crisp, something where the fruit can be locally grown, winter's over, and stick with what's in season.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is the author of the best-selling cookbooks Clean Food and Clean Start, Terry Walters. So I've noticed just from looking at your two books that are three years apart that it reflected the changing availability of products out there. I noticed that you had almonds as one of the basics in the first book and now almond meal in the most recent one. And these are kind of things that we can start discovering as the slow food and clean food and local food movements keep growing. We're getting more and more choices, and they really can enhance our palate quite a bit. Can you talk about some of the ingredients that you've discovered between the two books that have kind of made your kitchen livelier?
Absolutely. And not only ingredients that I've brought in, but some that I've taken out. So for instance, I took out the agave nectar. I'm not sure, you know, coconut oil was something that 15, 20 years ago, I was skeptical because I had was part of a, grew up part of a generation that said tropical oils are not heart healthy. And we had heart disease in our family. So I was very skeptical, but here I am now. And there's ample research that shows just the opposite. So I've taken out the canola oil, which thrills me to no end, and I'm using coconut oil in my baking. I've also taken out hijiki, which is a sea vegetable that started showing, being tested to show high levels of mercury. So I'm switching to seaweeds like arame and nori and using those exclusively, taking the hijiki completely out. So lots of change. And certainly gluten-free has been one of the hottest new developments in food as far as trending, as at least here on the East Coast.
Terry Walters, we were talking about the innovations in some of the new ingredients that have come up. But on the flip side, there's definitely been a movement to go back to some basics in terms of the supplies in your kitchen. I'm thinking not only people have gone back to using glass more to store their foods instead of plastics, but also eschewing these Teflon pans for the classic cast iron skillets. And I noticed that was one of the things that you recommended is a cast iron saute pan in your list of must-haves for your kitchen.
Cast iron, first of all, is indestructible. So that right there is great. And they're also incredibly cost-effective, very, very inexpensive, and very easy to use. So most of them these days come pre-seasoned, which seasoning cast iron is, I think, one thing that turned a lot of people away. But all you do is you take your cast iron and you rub some olive oil on it and stick it in a 350 oven for about 20 minutes. And that is how you season it. And it instantly becomes nonstick without any chemical sheeting like a Teflon or any of the other nonstick surfaces, and it won't, you're not going to have it peeling off and getting particles in your food. And when you use cast iron, you also leach edible iron, nutritional iron, into your food. So if you're, you know, making eggs, or it depends on how long it's there, but the longer your food is sitting in that iron, the more iron your food is getting. And iron actually is a super important and hard to come by in a lot of foods. So even spinach, which we think of as being so high in iron, it is. It's high in iron, but it's also very difficult for the body to assimilate much of that iron. So it's a great way of adding edible iron into your diet.
Terry Walters, she's the author of the best-selling cookbooks Clean Food and Clean Start. You can also find out more about Terry at terrywalters.net. That's T-E-R-R-Y, walters.net. Terry, thanks so much for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was great talking.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Gatemouth Brown, Louis Armstrong, and Taj Mahal. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.